Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Anxiety affects nearly 1 in 6 college students nationwide. At Ohio State University, they've seen a 43% spike in students seeking help for mental health issues in the last 5 years alone. To address the growing demand, OSU and campuses across the country are increasing the number of counseling workshops for students. Joining us is clinical psychologist at OSU's Office of Student Counseling and Consultation Service, Dr. Kip Petritonio. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good, thank you. Let's go back to that 43% spike, because you and I were talking off the air, and really there's a really important distinction to be made. That's just a 43% spike in what you're who you're serving.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So it's also ultimately limited by the number of counselors we have. Now, we've been blessed that we were granted a fair bit of money to hire quite a few new people this year. So our numbers are going to be even higher this year in terms of the number of people.
So the spike's a function of how much you're able to serve, not what the demand is out there.
Yeah, and the demand would probably be even higher.
So you have students coming to you wanting counseling, but you're like, no, I'm sorry, we're booked up for the semester.
Well, we offer a variety of services. Okay. So students always start with a triage phone call. So they give us a call. And some students need individual counseling. Some students would actually a group. We offer 30-plus groups at our center would be a little bit better. Sometimes one of our workshops that we do is a little bit better. Sometimes going over to wellness coaching, sometimes getting connected over to the student health center. So the first point of contact is actually helping the student figure out what would be the best treatment option for mm-hmm. them. And so that's kind of where we start. Is they go kind of to different places from there. The amount we're actually taking on, though, in terms of they want individual counseling, they want to come in and talk to somebody about anxiety, about depression, about academic pressure, that's that 43% we're looking at. So,
you're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about anxiety and depression among college students. There's an increase in demand for services at college counseling centers across the country, including at Ohio State University. My guest is Dr. Kip Petritonio. He is a counseling psychologist at OSU's Office of Student Life Counseling and Consultation Service. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Anxiety has surpassed depression as the leading mental health issue facing college students today. Talk about that and why you think that's the case.
Well, we have this really, really interesting phenomenon on college campuses. I like to call it the duck syndrome. Now, on the surface of a pond, all the ducks look like they're going along real smooth. It looks like nice and peaceful. And when you work at a college counseling center, you get to look under the water. And you see all the students paddling rapidly to keep that illusion alive. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening is students are feeling this really, really intense pressure to kind of keep that illusion alive, that they're doing great, they're doing fantastic, they're getting great grades, they're involved in 1,000 clubs, they're doing all the career prep and all this different stuff. And the truth is, like, it's just not maintainable for anybody to do everything all the time. And so plus keep up a social life, plus, figure out who they are. So those are some of the things that are going on. That in combination with, a really high level of student debt.
I suppose then you're seeing some kids start college with the anxiety issues because to get into college and to get onto the Ohio State campus and maybe get that scholarship they needed or whatever, mm-hmm. they were probably doing that stuff back in high school.
That's exactly right. Even all the way going back to when they were little kids between, dance, ballet, sports, clubs, organizations, going to events, it's kids have like busier schedules sometimes than CEOs of companies. And so, the average ACT coming into OSU this year's freshman class is a 29. Mm-hmm. I mean, that used to be just Ivy League schools, and mm-hmm. OSU is a great school, but I mean, it's really, really, we're getting the creme de la creme of folks who are applying at Ohio State, and the competition just keeps getting higher and higher and higher. Plus, we have 63,000 students who go to OSU altogether. You have to have classes where you have 500 kids in the class, and the way you get through that class is you have to test them. Because you can't grade 500 papers, right? So what happens
is... So it's multiple guess questions,
So if you're not a kid who's really great at high-pressured tests, you can get weeded out of your major really, really quick. So students are putting a lot of pressure. A physics exam might not be about, I might have to take physics again. It might be, I'm not going to get in my major. I can't do what I want in the long run. I have to stay another year and pay a couple extra $1,000 just, you know, or put that burden on my parents to pay an extra couple thousand dollars, because the student debt issue doesn't just affect like students from low income backgrounds anymore, because mm-hmm. the level of money you have to pay is so high. So mm-hmm. there's all of these things kind of contribute to the anxiety that students experience. And then I think the other piece is social media. Everybody gets to look at everybody else's highlight reel. You know, so you get on Facebook, you get on Snapchat, you get on Instagram.
Everyone's having a blast, right?
And that's our look at the pond above the surface, mm-hmm. right? Everybody's looking beautiful, amazing. Wow, look how successful everybody is. And here I am getting a C in physics, even though in reality, half the class is getting a C in physics, you know?
Right. So. John in Kettering, you're on the air. Hi, John. Hello, John.
Yes.
Go ahead.
The anxiety for college, the cost of college, that'd be a major anxiety for me.
The cost of college alone is, yeah, that's really gone up in the last couple decades.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, do they talk about, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this?
I think a lot of it is really fear of how they're going to afford to pay it back after the fact, or the undue burden it's going to put on their parents. Mm. There's a lot of guilt that students experience, like, oh my gosh, if I don't do well in this class, I have to stay for an extra year. If I have to stay for an extra year, that means X amount of money, you know, and it's different if they're, especially that really affects our international students, you know, who may be paying a really, really high fee to come on over to school. And, you know, if they're not getting good grades, they might not be able to stay in the country, get a visa. Like, there's some really high level of pressure for all kinds of students around that debt thing. So,
John, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. Are most students seeking help, or do you think there's a whole nother group in another pond that you're not even able to see?
I think a little bit of both. I think we tend to see more women than men. I think that stigma is a lot lower for women than it tends to be for men. About 30% of our caseload is males.
Huh.
And so I think men, there's still that stigma around being
and there's still
tough.
About 50% of mm-hmm. the students are.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. So, you know, we'd expect to see that a little bit higher. So we try to do some outreach around men's issues every year to really make a difference in that. But, you know, and that's one of the things is not everybody wants to come into individual counseling. That's a really intimidating thing for a lot of people, which is why we do things like our cool workshops, you know, like our Beating Anxiety workshop, which was, you know, it's kind of what brought me on the show today. So
how do you attract them to that? I mean, what does the Beating Anxiety workshop, what do you do there?
Okay. So how we attract people is we have it on our website. We have a really lively social media. We get it out there. Every person who's on a triage call gets invited to go to one of the workshops. So if you ever have contact with CCS, you are going to be told about a workshop at some point. What we do there is we talk together about what anxiety actually is. Because it seems kind of, it's like, you know, when you get stressed out, your body does all these crazy things, your mind is going a million miles an hour, what happens? And I help the students understand where it comes from, because if you understand what it is, then you can beat it. So what happens is we go back to evolution and we talk about how anxiety is this thing that's really helpful for life-threatening situations, right? So if you're a lion's chasing after you and you're a cave person back, you know, 30,000 years ago, your heart rate going fast, deep breathing, you're getting fidgety, you're ready to move, your body's getting you ready to run, getting you ready to move, your mind's thinking really fast, you're strategizing, right? That stuff is incredible for helping you survive a life-threatening situation. The problem is college students don't face life-threatening situations. They face tests and relationships and breakups. And all that body stuff is actually not only not helpful, actually gets in the way. So when you have to sit down and study for 7 hours for a test and your body is telling you, I got to move, I got to do something, mm-hmm. you know, it really works against you, especially when you're about to sit down and take a physics exam or
right. So
like
you
that.
Understand that about yourself, but you still have to study for the exam. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend? I mean, is it go out and run a couple miles or take a walk or what?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's actually, beating anxiety is not like a headache. You don't take a Tylenol
right.
for it.
Well, some people do, but or they
well,
take pills
and,
for and it,
that
and
won't
that's
be,
another issue.
Right, and that won't totally be effective anyway mm-hmm. for most people. So I actually tell people to do it. It's a four-prong approach. One is you got to take care of your biology. You got to take care of your emotions. You got to take care of your cognition. And then when you're actually freaking out in the moment, having a panic attack, what do you do? And so from the biological standpoint, you got to get your sleep. You got to be getting those 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night. You got to be eating healthy. You know, your digestive tract and everything has a really strong connection to both depression and anxiety. And you got to exercise every single week. And guess what are the first three things that go during finals week?
Mm. Exercise.
Sleep. Yeah. And eating. Yeah. People, those are the first things that go out the window. So we really try to emphasize those and getting that stuff in order, make sure you exercise every week. That's really going to help. Emotional is really helping people understand what you need from an emotional standpoint. So, a lot of students, you know, they tell their friend something, their friend gives them advice, they feel frustrated. You know, I'm really struggling in this class. It really is hard. I don't, you know, I feel like the professor doesn't like me. I don't know what I'm going to do. And the friend's like, well, I think you need to study harder. So it just takes your heart out. So really conveying like, hey, how do you get that emotional support? So one of the things I talk about in the workshop is, you know, not giving advice to friends. Mm. And instead just listening and being empathy and giving empathy to friends and sitting with friends and, you know, talking about similar situations when you've been through something similar and how, you know, how it was, how you felt and how it was really hard. And then encouraging students to talk about things in depth. Because I think part of that pond thing is that everybody wants to look good on the surface, mm-hmm. but they don't want to talk about, I'm scared, mm-hmm. I'm angry, I'm upset. This breakup is really messing with my ability to, you know, study for the test. Like, nobody wants to talk about that.
What's the suicide rate now?
I don't know if I have an exact number for like Ohio State's campus. It tends to be relatively high. It tends to be higher among men. Mm-hmm. The women tend to attempt suicide more. Men tend to complete suicide a little bit more. Most of the time that has to do with like the lethality means. And the sad thing is most of the time when people do complete suicide, they've never contacted a mm-hmm. counselor or never had any type of services. And that just takes the heart out of us over at CCS because we really want people to come in.
So when you're talking to students about how to respond to friends who are struggling, mm-hmm. does that come into the conversation?
Yeah.
Clues that when it's just anxiety or depression mm-hmm. and when it's what the tipping point can be for some people?
Definitely. And, you know, and talking about that division of what can you handle versus what, you know, do you need to kind of encourage them to come over to CCS? And we have an incredible student body. We have students walk students over all the time. And we also have faculty who are really wonderful, who will walk students over. And it's really wonderful to see that. Or we get a lot of, you know, we have a lot of positive outcomes from our work and the people refer to people. I would say almost every student I see is like, oh yeah, somebody else told me about counseling or they had a really great experience and they come on in. So we get a lot of word of mouth traffic too.
What about substance abuse issues? I mean, there's the recreational users. We know are legion on any mm-hmm. college campus. But what about people who are using, you know, buying Ritalin from yeah. friends to stay up all night and pull all-nighters? And then, of course, the whole addiction thing.
Yeah. You know, it's all over the place. It used to be that on college campuses, drinking
yeah.
was kind of it. But now we see a lot higher marijuana usage than we used to. And here's the thing is it's not the weed that people smoked back in the 60s. It was right out of the ground. It's this highly synthesized, you know, THC through a vaporizer, like really intense version of marijuana. And we're not as a country or especially, you know, from a political perspective, we're not at the point where we can talk about how marijuana affects different people differently, mm-hmm. like that it's not either good or bad for people, but that it has different effects on different people. We can all think of that with alcohol, right? Some people get angry, some people get sleepy, some people get competitive. It's the exact same thing with marijuana, and marijuana dramatically increases anxiety for a subset of people, and those just happen to be the people I see most of the time. So I'm helping them kind of realize the connection because
yeah.
they don't see it because they're like, well, marijuana helps me sleep. It chills me out, but they don't see how it affects their anxiety over time.
Yeah.
With Adderall and Ritalin and things like that, that often is tied to that high achievement level. Again, that people are, you know, using Adderall so they can stay up all night, study, which again connects back to our duck syndrome. You know, mm-hmm. they have to achieve. They have to be the best. They have to, you know, otherwise they're not going to get their job and all that catastrophized thinking kind of comes about. So,
and then just one last question. How much is it a function, any of this a function of the fact that maybe students are misplaced, that mm-hmm. they're in the wrong place. They shouldn't be here. This isn't the kind of college campus they should. You know, everybody's different.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody thinks they've got to get the degree and they've yeah. got to get it from a certain college or a certain university. And
yeah, you know, I think you're hitting a really great point, Anne. I think that's a real thing. And I think it even happens within college. People will go to an engineering major because their dad told them, like, I'm an engineer. You should be an engineer.
Yeah.
Even though they're incredible artists.
Yeah.
You know, even though they're really, really great at talking with people one-on-one. But they end up going, you know, into engineering. They end up not doing well. They feel like, oh, I'm not good, cut out for college. And then they leave, you know. And then there's, you know, there's a definitely a subset of people that, you know, could be incredibly successful if they started their own business, if they were to go get a welding associate's degree, or they were to, you know, something like that. And I think we don't value those alternative kind of degrees as a culture,
yeah.
You know, which we need people to do those jobs. And some of those jobs pay extremely well. So, but yeah, I think that you're definitely right that some students, there is this track idea. Like, if I have to go here to go to OSU, OSU then leads to success. Success, then I'm happy. And they forget that there's 40 or 50 years
in between
of life after college.
Right. You follow your passion, people. Dr. Kit Petrino-Tonio, I hope I haven't butchered your name too many times today. Notice I've avoided saying it. He's a counseling psychologist at Ohio State University's Office of Student Life Counseling and Consultation Services. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Ann, and happy Wellness Wednesday.
Thank you. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Join us today at noon for fresh air and a conversation about the public policy evolution of marijuana.
Hi, I'm Chris Thiele, the host of the new A Prairie Home Companion on 89.7 NPR News. Support 89.7 NPR News right now and be automatically entered in a sweepstakes to see the show live in St. Paul, Minnesota on February 18th. Your trip includes airfare, hotel accommodations, and two tickets. No gift is necessary, but your support helps to pay for the programs you enjoy. And hurry, the deadline to enter is Thursday. Don't miss this chance to see me for the new A Prairie Home Companion. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. High blood pressure often is associated with adult health issues, but like the rate of obesity, the incidence of high blood pressure in young children and adolescents has been steadily increasing over the last decade. Joining us now by phone from the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center is cardiologist Dr. Raghavendra Baliga. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Today, about 1 in 10 children either has hypertension or is considered at risk for developing it. But too often, high blood pressure goes undetected or isn't taken seriously in children. Why is that?
I think because blood pressure is an asymptomatic condition. That is, people don't have symptoms. So people ignore it because they don't see the effects of high blood pressure. And the effects of high blood pressure are often after a long duration of uncontrolled high blood pressure. And unfortunately, when it manifests, the effects are devastating. The three big, end, what we call as doctors, end organ damage because of high blood pressure is strokes, heart failure, kidney disease, or kidney failure. And these are three major vital organs which are affected. And unfortunately, with high blood pressure, there may be very little symptoms or no symptoms. And that's probably why it's ignored.
What's the protocol with children? When do they start getting their blood pressure checked?
I think with any well person's visit or when they go to their primary care physician, the blood pressure heart rate is checked routinely as far as they're seeking medical care, at least once a year.
What's considered normal blood pressure in children? I guess if you could compare it and contrast it to an adult blood pressure normal.
Well, it depends on the age of the child, and I'm an adult doctor, so I don't manage children very often, but I have children of my own, so I kind of know about this.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes by the age of the age of the child, because the size of the child, you know, is different at different ages. So they have different cutoff levels for different blood pressure for different ages.
Okay, so can you give me an example of how it would differ from a typical adult?
So it may be lower typically because they're you know, children are like a 10-year-old child is much smaller than a 21-year-old adult.
Mm-hmm.
So the blood pressure normally may be 10 or 20 points lower than an adult.
So when you're seeing high blood pressure in children, it's not the same kind of high blood pressure numbers when you look at an adult. So, you know, a physician, a pediatrician has to be familiar with those, what those markers are.
Exactly. And what may be perceived as normal in an adult may be on the higher side for children, because the higher numbers may be because the body size is so much smaller. Any higher blood pressure suggests higher numbers may be suggest high blood pressure, as opposed to in an adult, and maybe it may come across as normal.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about high blood pressure in children. About 1 in 10 children either has hypertension or is considered at risk for developing it. My guest is Dr. Raghavendra Baliga. He is a cardiologist at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I mentioned earlier that obesity is correlated with the increase in hypertension in kids. Do we know if it goes beyond correlation? Is it safe to say that's a big problem?
No question. The obesity is a big issue in children, and it is of great concern, because obesity contributes not only to high blood pressure, but it also contributes to high cholesterol increased cardiovascular risk down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're obese as a child, you're more likely to be obese as an adult. And so it is nice to sort of be proactive about it sooner than later and help your child along.
And are there other reasons for this uptick in the number of children with high blood pressure besides obesity, or is it pretty strongly, are we just conflating it with that?
I think as of now, if a young child has high blood pressure, it's probably obesity.
Hmm.
Because there are other causes of high blood pressure, and they should not be ignored, but they are rare compared to obesity as a cause for high blood pressure in a child.
In treating high blood pressure in children, I know that you don't specialize in pediatrics, but in treating it, does it differ much, or does it? How does it compare and contrast to how we treat it in adults?
Well, I think it's similar in many ways, because it's about paying attention to lifestyle and medications, depending on what the cutoff for high blood pressure is.
Okay, so medication in a child, they'd be taking basically the same sort of meds as an adult for high blood pressure, if that was the choice?
They may be, because there are 50 medications for high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And the medication list. So there's a lot to choose from, and depending on the patient's demographics, the pediatrician will decide the optimal therapy for each child.
Do you know if there's been much study done on children with hypertension or at risk of high blood pressure?
No, this is an evolving epidemic, because though we know there are some rare causes for high blood pressure, I think the amount of clinical trials in children are not. Then we don't have thousands and thousands of children with high blood pressure at this point, because mm-hmm. to do clinical trials. But the alarming increase in obesity and the accompanying increase in blood pressure clearly suggests that we may have more data as the obesity epidemic continues to be there.
With hypertension in children, does the damage to the organs, is it different? Is it because they're still developing, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of that's why in adults the damage is after it's developed, and in children it is damage while it's work in progress, so mm-hmm. to speak, with the organs. So no question, children are more resilient than adults, but that doesn't mean we should ignore it, and mm-hmm. in fact we should be more proactive. Because some of the changes may be long-lasting and lifelong and may be irreversible down the road.
Is there any chance that a child, you know, sometimes I know my kid used to get really nervous when we go to the doctors. I don't know why, but is there any reason to believe that that might be part of this too? Is the readings are off?
Yeah, so white coat hypertension. I mean, no one enjoys going to the doctor, including myself. So I can understand why the kids are nervous. So they recommend either to get the blood pressure checked by a nurse or randomly, or even there are some high quality. If ever your kid has high blood pressure when they go to the doctors, a good way of confirming it is to buy a blood pressure machine at home and just do it in a situation where the child is comfortable, and check the blood pressure and see whether the high blood pressure is confirmed in a sort of a soother setting.
In adults, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say 75 million Americans have high blood pressure and 2/3 don't know it. And you talked about earlier about the problem with blood pressure. It's a silent killer. That's about 1 in every 3 adults. If you're not going to the doctor regularly, you know, how are you going to know if you have it?
Yeah, and that's the sad part of it, because unlike in some lower income countries where they don't even have access to a doctor, by not going to the doctor and not checking your blood pressure, one would argue that you're getting the same amount of care as in a low income country that is no care.
Mm-hmm.
And the devastating effects of high blood pressure down the road are eminently preventable. And so I would encourage that some of the strengths of being in a high-income country or a first-world country is access to great medical care. Even checking vital signs like blood pressure, heart rate, can be done even by nurses, nurse practitioners, any healthcare provider, so as to speak. So I would encourage everyone to get at least an annual or maybe even twice a year blood pressure recordings.
You can get them at the pharmacy now in some places.
That is correct. Yeah. In pharmacy, and you can get it done even in the mall in some places.
A new study published by the Centers for Disease Control also found that nearly half of Medicare enrollees are not taking their high blood pressure medicine correctly. What's the proper way to take the medicine?
Well, I think one of the reasons for many of my patients who have high blood pressure do not take medications is because they're asymptomatic. They don't have symptoms. So it's very difficult to be kind of incentivized or motivated to take a medication when you have no symptoms. Unfortunately, when you have high blood pressure, it's like blowing a gasket in your blood supply to your brain and you get a stroke and the effects are long-lasting. And one way of ensuring that you take your medications, it's all about the power of habit, you know, the habit of taking medications. And I encourage people to buy a pill box, you know, something to prompt them to take their medication. Mm-hmm. And every week, for every day of the week, once a week, they can have their medications for each day in the pill box, and then they can sort of dutifully take their medications throughout the week rather than try to remember every day to take one pill out of a pill box out of the pill bottle every day.
Besides obesity, what causes high blood pressure? Because I've known people who are not obese by any means that are and at quite a young age in their 20s and 30s are suffer from high blood pressure.
Yeah, and so most of the cause for high blood pressure is idiopathic. That's a big medical term for saying we don't know.
Okay.
Or essential hypertension. And then there are some causes which are secondary to other conditions, which are pretty rare. But one of the important drivers for higher blood pressure is salt in the diet.
Hmm.
The recommendations from the FDA and other government bodies around 1.5 to 2 grams of sodium in a day. And people don't realize two slices of pizza makes that up, the sodium intake in a day.
Why is sodium associated with high blood pressure? Why does it cause that?
So the sodium affects the high blood pressure is, as I said, most of it is essential or we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And we have several theories for high blood pressure, but we don't know a cause for it. But what sodium does is it retains fluid in the body, and it also affects the vasculature, that's the blood supply, and causes probably the vasculature to constrict or to narrow down, increasing the blood pressure. That's kind of a very simple way of putting a complicated sodium homeostasis in a patient's body.
And so just cutting down, I mean, it's just being knowledgeable. Some people have to cut down more than others, though. The sodium affects them more than it does at other people?
Absolutely. And not everybody responds to sodium. Some people are more sensitive to sodium, and their blood pressure tends to go up higher than others, and others can handle high sodium diets, but it's very difficult for us to predict who is more sensitive than others. But generally speaking, all comers, lowering the sodium in the diet will improve the blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And eating TV dinners, eating out every day, it's all high salt intake if you eat out in restaurants. So I think the key is to learn how to read food labels.
Mm-hmm.
and then make a count of your sodium intake, one sodium intake every day. Unfortunately, if you're not, you know, if you go to restaurants, if you're not a good cook, what do? You throw salt in the diet, salt in the food, and it tastes good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easier to eat a diabetic diet without sugar than to eat a low salt diet. In fact, if you have a no salt diet, you can't eat the food at all.
Interesting.
And we need some salt in the diet.
Right.
And so the recommendation is about 1.5 to 2,000 milligrams of sodium in a day. And the average American eats 8 to 10 milligrams of sodium in a day, 8 to 10 grams of sodium in a day. And those who eat TV dinners and eat out every day eat 22 grams. So there's a huge opportunity to improve our diets.
And just stay away from processed foods for starters,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Baliga, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Raghavendra Baliga. He is a cardiologist at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Fall is peak concussion season when the most popular contact sports, football and soccer, are also in season. And a new report by Blue Cross Blue Shield shows that the rate of diagnosed concussions in children and young adults has risen sharply since 2010. Gretchen Reynolds, columnist for the New York Times Well blog, recently wrote about that and other exercise news. She joins us now. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So partly that's just because they're getting better at diagnosing, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot of these concussions are the kinds of injuries that 20 years ago, you know, we told kids, shake it off. I didn't tell them that. The coaches definitely did. There was no sense that this was actually an injury. So no one took that child to a doctor. So we are seeing a huge increase in the number of children who are being diagnosed with concussions. But most experts also think that we are seeing a very large increase in children. And the report that you mentioned was looking at children under the age of 20. And almost every expert believes that there is a very large increase in the number of young children, some of under 10, who are experiencing concussions.
Is that because of the growing popularity of, say, soccer?
Oh, certainly, yes. And it's also that more children are participating in a number of these sports. More of them are doing it year-round. Some of them are doing it under both coaches and referees who are not particularly experienced. That if children don't follow the rules, that's when you start seeing a lot more injuries. If children under the age of 10 are doing a lot of heading, if they're doing a lot of, you know, full contact practices, then yes, you do see a very significant increase in head injuries.
This study is considered one of the most comprehensive ever. Why? What about it makes it special?
Well, in this case, it was produced actually by the Blue Cross Blue Shield Insurance Company, and they looked at the number of diagnoses in their database across the country, and what they found was a huge increase in the number of children who are diagnosed. But what that also suggests is this is a narrow group of kids. These are the kids whose parents are insured by Blue Cross. So the actual number of concussions is almost certainly much larger than was seen in this report. And in this report, since 2010, there was more than a 70% increase overall in the diagnoses of concussions, the numbers. But girls saw almost a 120% increase. And boys, while the increase wasn't as large, the numbers were really, really large. And that's very concerning.
How did they conduct this study? What were they looking at particularly?
Well, they were looking very, very straightforwardly at the code that said this child is diagnosed with a concussion.
Okay.
So they weren't looking at the severity. They weren't looking at whether the children had more or less. This was a pretty straightforward, how many kids are being diagnosed with a concussion? And the numbers really did soar between 2010 and 2015. And again, some of that is going to be because parents, coaches, referees, everyone are now looking for that. And most states do have laws now that a child who is suspected of sustaining a head impact must be removed from the game or removed from the practice and must be seen by a doctor. That was not true 15 years ago. So yes, we are seeing more diagnoses. We also almost certainly are seeing more actual head injuries than 10, 15 years ago.
And it matters. The consequences from head injuries in youth have largely remained unknown, but there's a new study out of Sweden that helps shed a little more light on the long-term effects. What did they find there?
Yes, and this, I really don't want to frighten the heck out of parents everywhere because I am one. I'm a soccer mom. But this study looked at the very long-term consequences of a child sustaining a concussion and or a more severe head injury. But they also looked at concussions. And Sweden has a really elaborate system of databases about the health of everyone in Sweden. So they looked at the number of people under the age of 20 who sustained a head injury. And then they followed them for 40 years.
Wow.
And they checked to see how well they did in educationally, whether they sought treatment for mental health or physical injuries. And they also looked at whether one of their siblings, who had not been hurt, experienced difficulties. And it turned out that if a child had had a head injury, a concussion, they were much less likely to finish high school, to go to college, and were much more likely to have psychiatric issues and health issues, physical issues, than their sibling who had never been hurt.
So, that's pretty shocking.
It is. And again, that it wasn't a guarantee. If a child, you know, sustained one concussion, there was no, you know, they did not necessarily have problems. But the risk was much higher than the general population in Sweden and much higher than their brother or sister who had not had a head injury. So, I mean, the message is pretty clear. Don't let your child hit his or her head if it's at all possible. And my son played soccer. He's in college now and still plays there. Mm-hmm. But he played throughout elementary school, high school, all of that. I would not have stopped him. I would say if you are a parent, make sure that the coach follows all the rules and recommendations about what you do during practice, whether it's football, soccer, basketball, anything. Children get concussions in swimming. So the thing is to not coddle them, not, you know, no one would say don't have children play sports, don't have them run around. Everyone would say try to make sure that your children follow all the rules, their coaches, referees follow the rules. Try and keep them as safe as we can and try to avoid concussions.
It's going back to that 119% increase in the rate of concussions for girls. Is that just because it's a much larger increase than for boys? But of course, girls, you know, haven't played at the same rates as boys for a long time. And also, I'm wondering if the rigor and the vigor of girls is increasing in sports.
I would say most experts would say it's both. There are more girls participating, so the numbers go up. They're also, and this is a little more subtle, but there has, until pretty recently, generally tended to be a little less experience among some of the coaches who are working with girls.
Okay.
That's not as true as it was.
Right.
But there are issues of whether some of it relates to the physiology and biology of girls or whether it relates to sociological issues. It also relates to just pure math. There are more girls participating now, and girls do seem to have a higher risk, particularly in soccer, than boys. Just number for number, a girl is more likely than a boy in soccer to sustain a concussion. And that we just don't know why. But it does mean that if you were the parent of a girl, you might be just a little bit more cautious. Talk to her about heading. Talk to her about, you know, talk to the coach about all of that. Make sure, again, that the coach follows all of the rules in your state about when children should be removed from play, what age they should start heading, all of those sorts of issues. I mean, we're not going to prevent all concussions. It's just not going to happen. But if both players and all the authorities around them follow all the rules, the numbers will go down.
What is the protocol for assessing post-concussion in children? What should you expect that they'll get once they've been diagnosed?
You know, that actually does differ from state to state, and I do not know all of the state regulations. I would say if you are a parent of a child who has sustained any kind of head injury, even if you just suspect it, take your child to an actual neurologist. It's a really good idea to go not just to your general practitioner, but actually to see a neurologist and have them assessed immediately afterwards and talk to the neurologist about what the neurologist thinks constitutes return to play when your child is ready. And it may mean that your child needs to take some time off school as well as off of sports, because a head injury does have impacts on how well a child does in school. And there are questions about when the child is ready to return. And it does seem to differ from child to child. So I would definitely say consult with an actual neurologist.
And are you curious, or has anything been written about why Blue Cross Blue Shield did this? Because it makes me wonder if they're not setting up evidence for, you know, like you could charge higher rates, you know, for people who smoke, that kind of a thing. Can you charge higher, you know, premiums for people whose kids do sports?
You know, I doubt that. I don't actually know some of the background. I think that they did it in part because there is so much interest right now in just how widespread the problem of childhood concussions really is. Mm-hmm. And we haven't had good numbers, in part because it only has been recently that people have started taking it really seriously and also have put together sort of real diagnostic criteria for what constitutes a concussion. And that actually can differ from doctor to doctor. Obviously, if a child loses consciousness, that's a concussion. But there is some gray area in that, you know, if someone knocks their head, whether they have sustained a concussion or not. So I think Blue Cross needs to know, you know, whether how many of their patients are sustaining these. And they do need to tell parents that this is not a rare occurrence. It is happening more often than it seems to have been happening a decade ago. And we do need to be aware of that. I think that by and large, both insurers and parents would agree it's better to have your child being physically active than not.
Mm-hmm.
That health implications are much more severe for children who are heavily overweight. We want our children to be out and active, but we also want them to be as safe as they can be, because the implications and repercussions mm-hmm. of a concussion may linger lifelong. We just don't know yet.
You know, I was talking with a counseling psychologist at OSU about, you know, the increased rates in anxiety and depression among students. And one of the prescriptions for all of that is exercise. It's one of the best ways to alleviate anxiety. And also it works on the brain when it comes to depression. You've written frequently about how physical activity aids our brains and minds. And that's what you're trying to say is for heaven's sake, don't stop exercising. A new study has found, though, that many of those benefits vanish once we stop exercising. I mean, it's that quick. Dang it.
Yes, it seems kind of unfair if
it's
you exercise.
Totally unfair, Gretchen.
In this case, they actually looked at lifelong master's runners, really serious runners, and they were looking at brain implications. And there's very good evidence that exercise increases blood flow to your brain, which is really important. It brings more fuel, it brings more oxygen, it seems to help stimulate the creation of new brain cells there if you have more blood flow. And so all of these master's runners had just excellent brain blood flow. And so they asked them to become couch potatoes for 10 days to not exercise. And at the end of 10 days, these people who had exercised all their lives had much worse blood flow to the brain.
That's so wrong.
Yeah, so, yeah, the lesson is you can't quit.
You can't quit. No, exactly. In fact, they tell me I have to exercise more. Exercise also increases, as you said, the birth of new brain cells, but you've written that there could be a downside to that. What's the deal with that?
Well, the issue is whether if you develop new neurons in your brain, if you essentially erased the old ones, if you would, by creating new brain cells and new memories, if you then made it much harder to access the old ones. And there was some evidence in mice that was true, because mice, when they developed new neurons that then had new memories written onto them, they seemed to forget things that they had known before. That doesn't seem to be true in people.
Okay, I was going to say it explains so much, but next...
no. In this case, it was pretty clear that even as people made new brain cells through exercise, it did not affect their memory. So for us, it appears to be only good for our brains to exercise.
So no
but
excuses.
Only bad if we quit.
Right. Only for 10 days. Well, Gretchen Reynolds, thanks as always for joining us. I always appreciate your insights.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Gretchen Reynolds is a columnist for the New York Times Well blog. We'll have a link to her columns on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If that's about it for Wellness Wednesday today, thanks for listening. As always, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.